Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Coming to a trench near you, Naked Archaeology.
Hello and welcome to Naked Archaeology from the Naked Scientists with me, Diana O'Carroll.
And me, Tom Birch.
This month we're following the illicit trade in archaeological antiquities. Ancient objects can make a lot of money, but it's a huge problem for archaeologists and politicians alike. But how big a problem is it?
The truth is that countries with a glorious historical ancient past, like Greece, for example, or Italy, or Egypt, or Iran and Iraq, were very, very severely plundered and been severely excavated, in inverted commas, of course, brutally, actually, by people that are not archaeologists and are only for a profit.
Christos Tsirogiannis will be telling us about his work tracking down those illicit objects looted from Greece in just a moment. But from Greece to Ireland, what are the troubles faced by museum curators in finding out if what they do want to display is legitimate?
A huge number of archaeological objects that found their way into museums had, it has to be stated quite unambiguously, very dodgy pedigrees. Museums were not averse to grabbing material under the counter if they could. Not anything like so much now as they used to, but it was done by almost all museums, and the bigger the museums, the better they were at it.
Richard Warner will be taking us through those problems shortly. Plus, in backyard archaeology, I'll be typologising some gravestones. It's easier than it sounds. That's all to come up on Naked Archaeology.
Naked Archaeology. Exposing the finds.
This is Naked Archaeology from the Naked Scientists, and first up this month, Diana spoke to Christos Tsirogiannis from Cambridge University about his work in tracking down illicit antiquities. And it's no easy task, as a lot of the time there's no record of these items having gone missing in the first place. Unfortunately, the illicit trade in antiquities is a problem, which affects many countries, some more than others. But this can provide some embarrassment for their governments, which only makes the jobs of people like Christos harder.
An illicit antiquity is an antiquity that had been illegally excavated, illegally exported, illegally traded, illegally acquired by a museum, institution, private collector, and illegally, of course, after all this illegal procedure, illegally exposed and presented to the audience. Is an antiquity that has no provenance, legal provenance, and especially has no legal documentation, permission from the country of origin to be exported and then to legally be sold.
And how big is the problem? Can you define it in terms of scale?
The problem is huge. Actually, it's so bad that I have the honor to have as a supervisor Chris Chippindale, and is well known to archaeological community, the Chippindale's law, that says more or less that whenever things seems to be bad, the truth is really much, much worse than it seems to be. So, yes, the truth is that countries with a glorious historical ancient past, like Greece, for example, or Italy, or Egypt, or Iran and Iraq, were very, very severely plundered and been severely excavated, in inverted commas, of course, brutally, actually, by people that are not archaeologists and only for a profit. All this kind of stuff that dealers worldwide, especially in the Western world, and now the last decade also in Far East, that saying that they are interested mostly in art, it's not true. At the end, it's all about money.
So how are you going about trying to locate these artifacts which have no legal provenance, as you said?
Well, the Robin Symes and Christos Michailidis archive that was confiscated in Skinous Island during a raid of the Greek Police Department of Illicit Antiquities on April 2006 was discovered extremely suddenly, because we have to say here that Robin Symes and Christos Michailidis were the top illicit antiquities dealers in the world. For us, it was a very happy surprise, because all the police department of illicit antiquities around the world were searching to find this archive, and was found in a remote island of the Cyclades in Skinous Island, where was a Roman-type villa, was built, complex of villas, actually, that Robin Symes and Christos Michailidis used to spend their summers there. This archive is a photograph archive and is depicting only a small proportion of the huge quantity of illicit antiquities that Robin Symes and Christos Michailidis traded for more than 35 years, but on the top of the illicit antiquities dealers world for 25 years, for a quarter of a century.
So how do you go about matching this massive photographic archive up with what's missing?
Well, I had the opportunity to work and the honor to work as an archaeologist in the Greek Police Department of Illicit Antiquities and then to the Greek Ministry of Justice. The Italians, that Carabinieri have the best art squad, police art squad in the world, in searching, identifying and claiming back to repatriate illicit antiquities, they did a great job almost a decade before the Greeks get active in that case, and identified the material for confiscated archives that were found in the premises and warehouses of Italian dealers that were raided in Switzerland, by, of course, searching the collections of the museums, especially the North American ones, and the private collections that were formed, and auction houses, dealers, and, of course, all these came from the same suppliers, either in top illicit antiquities level dealers, like Robin Symes, Christos Michailidis, Robert Bob, as he's well most known, Hecht, and, of course, other Italian origin dealers like Giacomo Medici, Gianfranco Becchina, and several others.
So this stuff, it's not only ending up in private collections, it's also ending up in quite legitimate museums.
Well, legitimate museums are museums who are legitimate. If they are involved in these actions, we cannot really call them legitimate, I think. Maybe they are legitimate when they have to deal with paintings or china or every other contemporary art. But antiquities is a matter of having a mature relationship, and when you deal with ancient past, and you have to respect the history and the culture of nations that maybe are not today in the position to defend the way they wanted to their cultural heritage. It's all about moral issues, and this is the basis, according to my opinion at least, of humanities. And archaeology, at least in University of Cambridge, is part of humanities studies, so we have to respect and to try to approach this kind of matters with the same moral basis wherever we are.
And how successful have you been in repatriating some of these lost antiquities?
Well, I had the honor to participate in a small group in Greece that worked exclusively for repatriation cases. And we had finally succeeded to repatriate all four pieces that we were claiming from the Jean Paul Getty Museum. For 14 years we were claiming that. Apart from that case, we had the opportunity to work in other cases as well, like the Selby White collection, that we began the claim of two certain pieces, the upper part of a funerary marble attic, Athenian that is, stele, and bronze, a huge bronze Hellenistic period crater of funerary use, that both of them were repatriated in Greece. And to bring back part of a stolen collection of prehistoric idols, figurines, the Theodoropoulos collection that was stolen from Larissa in the Thessaly in middle part of Greece many, many years ago. Also, we started other cases like the Michael Carlos Museum case in Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, a case that still goes on, or it's frozen probably. Now nobody is working on it. Well, this group was formed very quickly, worked very actively, and unfortunately, quite quickly was dismantled, and no one of us is anymore working on repatriation issues in Greece.
So who is your group composed of?
Well, first of all, was the public prosecutor Ioannis Diotis, who was the one who arrested and convicted the most long-lived in Europe terrorist groups. That was the 17th of November in ELI. Then was the investigative reporter of Kyriakatiki Eleftherotypia, that is in Greek Sunday Free Press, Nikolas Zirganos. He, until 2006, had as a hobby to research about the Internationalist Antiquities Network. The legal advisor of former Greek Minister of Culture Yorgos Vulgarakis, Irini Stamatoudi, who is a lawyer and was specialized and expert on cultural heritage, and of course Georgios Gligoris, who was the head of the police department of illicit and stolen antiquities, the guy who dared to take the decision and raid the premises, the villa of Marion Trou in Paros. Marion Trou, the former curator of Greek and Roman antiquities in the wealthiest museum of the world, the Jean-Paul Getty Museum. And of course the big raid in Skinoussa Island at the premises of Robin Symes and Christos Michailidis, the top dealers in the world for more than a quarter of a century. And I have to mention here that because of these successful raids, Georgios Gligoris was rewarded, in inverted commas the word, by the Greek state to be thrown out of being head of the police, illicit antiquities police department, and to be sent in the western borders of Greece, in a small island called Lefkada, to run a local police station. 6 months later, he was accidentally involved in a car accident that left him in a coma situation for 2 weeks, and he eventually passed away on the 13th of March 2009. And of course that's a story that shows that if there is no political will or true patriotism, nothing can flourish in fighting this global illicit antiquities crime.
And we celebrate his achievements. This was Christos Tsirogiannis, PhD student at the University of Cambridge, who is working on tracking down illicit antiquities and has played a key role in repatriating quite a few.
35 years worth of archive from Robin Symes and Christos Michailidis. That must be an incredible record of looted objects. You're listening to Naked Archaeology, and you can find more episodes on the web at thenakedscientist.com/archaeology or on iTunes, plus many more podcasts on science from the Naked Scientists. Still to come, how a museum curator deals with the problems of illicit antiquities. But it's time for the news this month, and it seems that snacking in the theatre in the past wasn't just about ice cream. Tom?
Yes, well, this month it emerged with the report from the Museum of London that we can have an insight into the medieval diet. David Keyes published a fascinating article in The Independent last month about snacking habits in Tudor times at the Globe Theatre in London.
Can you just remind me why the Globe is important?
Well, Diana, it was built in 1587 and is famous for playing some of the works by Christopher Marlowe and William Shakespeare.
Okay.
Well, archaeologists have been meticulously studying the thousands of pips, seeds and food remains such as shellfish, fish and animal bones. And this was all done as part of the investigation into the Tudor early Stuart period Rose Playhouse on London South Bank. The report written by Julian Boucher and Pat Miller and published by the Museum of London Archaeology reveals a fascinating insight into the munching mouthfuls of fans of William Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe. The theatre-goers ate your usual seafood snacks, such as oysters, crabs, cockles and mussels. They were even into periwinkles and whelks. As for their fruit and fibre, the laughing crowds were chomping on walnuts, hazelnuts, as well as the plums, raisins, cherries, peaches and dried figs.
It doesn't sound all that unusual for a trip to the theatre.
Well, Diana, that's where you're wrong. The evidence also shows that the audience were enjoying exotic delights from the New World. Marrows, pumpkin seeds have been identified in the assemblage, and that's not all. Pipe tobacco, originally from the Americas, was also found, and may suggest that some of the crowd were puffing away whilst watching Dr. Faustus.
Well, tobacco sounds like a bit of an elite commodity. I mean, surely that would have been really expensive.
Well, it seems so. The fast food nation, chewing away, were apparently divided in two. Not in the old age, you know, fighting East versus West, but yes, the age-old class divide. Only the wealthy could afford imported delights such as raisins and dried figs and peaches. However, it does seem that everyone enjoyed the odd sturgeon steak and plenty of mum's elderberry and blackberry pie. And I hear there's been a new finding on the earliest migrations into the Americas.
Yes, that's right. This month, in a lovely bit of science, geneticists have reconstructed the phenotype, that is, how they looked, of an ancient human thought to be about 4,000 years old.
I thought you could tell how a person looked from doing facial reconstruction.
Well, that's the tool used for the last few decades, but in this case, the researchers at the University of Copenhagen have come to their conclusions from just a sample of hair. The hair was excavated from Greenland in the 1980s and has been stored in the Natural History Museum in Denmark ever since, but Esker Villerslev and his team have managed to reconstruct almost the entire genome of this 4,000-year-old individual from the hair.
Why hasn't this been done before, Diana?
Well, reconstructing ancient genomes is, first of all, expensive. A lot of the techniques used are pricey because of the amount of labour involved, and the technology used to process all of that genetic information comes at a premium. Plus, ancient DNA is very fragmentary, so you have to work quite hard at piecing it back together. Another problem is that it's very easy for ancient DNA to become contaminated by modern people handling the sample, so you have to make sure you keep an eye out for your own DNA turning up.
So they managed to get the cache and the genome, but what could they tell about the phenotype, how this man looked?
Well, he had a tendency to baldness, he had dry earwax, brown eyes, dark skin, blood type A positive, and shovel-shaped front teeth. They also discovered that he was closely related to modern northeastern Siberian people, but had no modern descendants among the Inuit of North Americas. So they think this means there was a more recent migration to the Americas about 5,000 years ago.
And there could be more finds like this if geneticists worked on existing museum collections?
Yeah, there's plenty more that can be done with this technology, and if you want to follow it up, then the study is published in the journal Nature. Earlier this month, I spoke to the archaeologist Richard Warner, who's been based at the Ulster Museum since the 1960s. When acquiring objects for a museum collection, curators have to be especially wary of where these items come from. So I asked Richard how he dealt with the problem during his term.
The most obvious problem is that of the integrity of what the arts world call provenance. So an archaeologist, provenance has a very specific meaning. It actually nowadays is used just to mean where the object was found in a physical sense. But in the wider museum and art world, provenance also has to do with historic ownership. That is, does the object have a consecutive, continuous record proving in some way that it isn't a stolen object or an object having questionable origins? It's important in archaeology because increasingly, well, in the past as well, a huge number of archaeological objects that found their way into museums had, it has to be stated quite unambiguously, very dodgy pedigrees. Museums were not averse to grabbing material under the counter if they could. Not anything like so much now as they used to, but it was done by almost all museums, and the bigger the museums, the better they were at it. Nowadays, there is a lot of internal questioning going on. Curators increasingly now demand that there is full disclosure goes with objects. Now, interestingly enough, in Northern Ireland and in the Republic of Ireland, where there are laws governing the reporting of objects, it is much less common that this sort of information is hidden. But in Britain, where the Portable Antiquities Act is very much a voluntary thing, people can put any sort of information onto objects, and they're not in any way risking legal retribution because it's not a compulsory thing for them to do.
Could you just explain what the Portable Antiquities Scheme is, and what does full disclosure count as? I mean, what does it look like? How can you prove that an object has a real provenance?
You could never prove anything. Well, we don't have, in Northern Ireland, we don't have the Portable Antiquities Scheme. That's only an English thing. Basically, it says that it encourages people to report objects they find, particularly treasure hunters, who are very, very active in England. It encourages to report the objects so that in England, for instance, things like treasure hunting and excavating do not require any sort of legislation covering them. They don't require licenses or anything like that. Anybody can go out and dig a site as long as they have the landowner's permission, and anybody can treasure hunt, and people do whether they have the landowner's permission or not. In both parts of Ireland, both treasure hunting and digging without a license are prohibited. This means that those activities are far less common over this side of the water than they are over there. But it also means that there is an automatic feeling when people report an object to you that if they got caught telling a porky, then the law would actually come down on them. So it is certainly the belief of most of us that they would be less likely under those circumstances to lie about how that object was found and where it came from.
And during your tenure at the Ulster Museum, did you ever encounter any suspicious and shady characters? I'm sure you must have.
Oh, God, yes. I'm afraid, being the person I am, I always worked on the basis that the person was suspicious and shady and let them prove to me that they weren't. And that was quite a useful way of doing it because one tended to get pleasant surprises rather than the opposite. On the whole, it turned out that many of the people that I was suspicious about, particularly within the treasure hunting fraternity, turned out to be quite reasonable people. Many, I don't say all, but many did.
And what about the objects themselves? Do you think the old adage, or more recent adage, is true that they belong in a museum? What do you think should happen to them if they don't have this proper provenance? Where should they go?
It's an interesting one, and one that I had a lot of discussions with a colleague of mine, this whole question about should the object, as it were, be tainted by its history? This is a hard one. My tendency is to say that an object shouldn't be tainted, that an object should not be dismissed and allowed to disappear simply because one was worried about its history or because its history was provably dodgy. I think any action ought to be on the person, not on the object. In other words, I would more approve of the idea that where someone can be shown to have behaved either immorally or illegally, or have been less than straight, then they simply don't receive anything like the reward that they might otherwise have received.
So how do you feel about the repatriation of antiquities that have been exported by dealers?
I'm a very strong supporter of the principle of repatriation. I understand the argument that is very common now, that objects, that the heritage belongs to the world. But I think much more strong is the fact that the heritage is something that belongs to place. It illustrates place. And therefore, as it is now easy to travel, if somebody wants to see somebody else's heritage, I think it's more important that they should go to that country to see it than that it should be made available in their country on a permanent basis. As an example, the people in Nigeria were finding it very difficult to see any decent collection of Benin material because so much of it is in places like Berlin and London and America. And this is a serious problem. As an example, for instance, more locally, the British Museum has a better collection of early medieval metalwork than the Ulster Museum does from Northern Ireland. This is an unacceptable situation, particularly as most of it is not on display. Why would they have it? They don't have any need to have it. So whether it's done as a formal transfer of ownership or done on the basis of permanent loans, it doesn't really matter. There is already a procedure in existence in Britain that is supposed to encourage museums to send material on permanent loan to museums that would better have it. Particularly national museums are supposed to do this. They don't do it, but they're supposed to. I would like to see a much, much stronger attitude towards making sure material is available within that area to which that material culturally belongs.
Richard Warner speaking there about how museum curating is not quite the armchair archaeology many would have you believe.
But now it's time for backyard archaeology. And if there's a graveyard near you, there's something you can try out without a trowel this time. I met up with Dawn Elise Mooney from the University of Aberdeen, a PhD candidate, to do a bit of gravestone typologising.
Well, today I'm at the Kirk of St Nicholas, a large church off Union Street in the centre of the city of Aberdeen. And I'm a bit complex as to why I'm here with Dawn Mooney from the University of Aberdeen, the Department of Archaeology. Dawn, why have you dragged me here today?
Well, graveyards are actually really interesting, Tom, in terms of both relative dating and in terms of how the imagery on them just changes according to different religious beliefs. So there's actually a lot you can learn from the graveyard. It's mostly Victorian today, but there are memorials relating from much older periods as well.
Okay, so we're here today to look at gravestones. That sounds quite fascinating. So, Dawn, let's go walking. Well, Dawn, around me there are various different types of gravestones, monuments, I'm not quite sure what to call them. They all are rather different, but there's some clear themes here. Would you mind just telling our listeners what sort of gravestones or monuments we have in this kirk?
We have actually quite a lot here. We have ones that are more wall-mounted, which are dating from maybe the 16th, 17th century. They would have previously been in the church, perhaps, but have been moved out into the graveyard itself. But around us, we can see all different kinds, really. You have obelisks, sarcophagi, table or bench-style monuments, flat slabs on the floor, and, of course, the more familiar sort of headstone tombstones that we can see in most modern graveyards.
Excellent. So we've got a variety of monuments here. Now, let's get to the nitty-gritty. What can this tell us in terms of typology? What's the point of being able to look at these different styles and say, I know when it comes from?
Well, we can actually see through changing art styles and changing beliefs that the way in which people were buried or the style of their tombstones has changed a lot over the years. In the 16th and 17th centuries, they were normally fairly kind of simple, not very sophisticated, just initials and date of death, maybe date of birth as well. We get headstones, we get flat slabs, which, like I said earlier, might have originally been in the church, and they would have belonged to people of much higher standing who could afford to have this beautiful carved slab made for them. And they're common in all over Britain, really. And they also might have a coat of arms if you've got a really important family there. And then moving on to the late 17th century, we get much more elaborate styles of gravestones. You get the Rococo style coming in, but also you may have much more simple rustic styles. And again, that probably reflects socioeconomic differentiations rather than necessarily beliefs, although it may have both. Moving on, you start to see the classical revival in the late 17th and early 18th century. So Romanesque designs, that kind of thing. And then the sort of Gothic revival of the 19th century comes in. So there's a whole range of things where just people have taken elements which have been in style, in vogue, inspiring poetry and literature at the time, and have added them into their funerary monuments.
Well, Dawn has brought me to this rather plain, regular-looking gravestone, which is white and very pointed angular top. Dawn, why have you brought me to this one gravestone in particular?
This is actually one of my favourites. It stood out to me at first because it's painted white, which is quite interesting in a graveyard full of tombstones made of granite, which are very grey and dull. But actually, the most interesting thing is at the bottom it says, "Here rests John Anderson, Wizard of the North, died the 3rd of February, 1874.
Yeah, Wizard of the North, that's quite an inscription you'd have for that period on a gravestone. It does sound a little bit pagan almost, but this isn't pagan, is it, at all? Who is this guy, Dawn?
Well, I looked him up, and it turns out that he's actually one of the first magicians to, well, the first, in fact, magician to bring magic tricks, conjuring, illusions from the sort of circus into the theatres. And he started off as a blacksmith's apprentice, I believe, and ended up touring all over the world, all over Europe and America, doing magic shows and these amazing illusions that no one had ever seen before.
So in front of us we have one of Britain's, if not the world's, first most spectacular magicians.
Yes, exactly.
In this cemetery we've actually got a few minor celebrities, so let's just go over and see one of them now. Perhaps minor celebrity is an understatement. We're stood in front of a very large, prominent cross, which is a Celtic cross. And on it, at the bottom, we have an anchor with a rope tied around it. Is this bearing any relationship to the person named on it, on this gravestone, Dawn?
Yes, it is, actually. The gravestone is erected in memory of Captain William Penny of Aberdeen, who has actually got quite an interesting link to maritime history. He was an Arctic discoverer, as it says on the tombstone, like I would say explorer personally, who assisted in the Franklin search expedition of 1850 and 1851. And Franklin was one of the first to really go out and explore the Arctic, not really to discover the North Pole or to reach the North Pole, but he got lost and went missing. So I imagine Captain William Penny was part of the rescue expedition that went in search of him.
So some of the images we have on these gravestones are, well, symbolic. They contain a lot of meaning. They can be to do with belief, perhaps occupation or trade, as we discovered with the anchor. Dawn, could you just maybe describe to us a few of these images and what they mean?
Well, the anchor actually in itself is quite interesting, because apart from, in this case, symbolising his trade and his vocation in life, it also symbolises steadfast hope, which I think is quite interesting considering Captain William Penny's relation to this rescue expedition. But there are various other ones. Most of them symbolise, you know, virtues, such as the lily symbolising purity and resurrection, the oak symbolising strength, the olive branch symbolising peace. Some of them are also a little bit more morbid. There's the skeleton representing life's brevity, or the broken sword representing life cut short.
Oh, they are quite quite profound then. So I think to finish on that note, in the Kirk of St. Nicholas on a beautiful summer's day, we're going to walk past an urn on a column, which is draped with a cloth. What does this mean, Dawn?
Symbolises mourning and grief.
Oh, what a happy day. Well, that's us at St. Nicholas Kirk. We're going to carry on wandering around the gravestones and chat a bit about their typology. Thank you, Dawn.
Thanks, Tom.
I was speaking to Dawn Mooney from the University of Aberdeen about how you can go round your graveyard and find out how old a grave is and maybe what the occupation and status of the individual was.
That's it for Naked Archaeology this month. You can find more episodes at thenakedscientist.com/archaeology. And if you want to get in touch with questions or comments, then do so by emailing archaeology@thenakedscientists.com.
Laying the artifacts bare. Naked Archaeology.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.